is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 27th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 12th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, massive tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Think Realty, Coach Fullerton, Keller Williams Corona, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
Thank you for this award. I appreciate it very much. I'm reminded of Socrates when he went to get a haircut, and his barber asked him, "How would you like your haircut?" And Socrates said, "In silence." So I'm going to be very short with this, but I will tell you that if you ever want to learn something, teach it. You'll get enough questions that it will force you to learn all the nuances of whatever you're teaching. And I learned that early on, fortunately, and I've enjoyed the teaching. It's not only been an income stream, which obviously people understand, but it's also been a source of education for me. You know, what's happening in everybody else's marketplace? And I was able to use that not only to improve my teaching, but improve my investing. So thank you all for this. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is about the children tonight, so remember that.
Watching Debbie tear up was everything to me. Thank you for supporting what he did. Very important. All right. We're going to have three panels that will ultimately be up here. I'm going to do what's called an economic panel. We'll have three people up here with me. And then Aaron will do three that will have to do the tech world, which I can't be a part of because I don't have a clue. But Aaron does. And then collectively, we'll have a panel where I'll be asking questions at the end of the evening. All six people will be up there, and I'll do my best to try and engage everybody in something that's meaningful. We have a lot of very smart investors in the audience, and when I speak in front of you, I realize there's some concern. And so a lot of the questions that I've thought about to ask tonight has kind of come from you and what you've been concerned about. And so that's what we'll be doing all the rest of the night. There'll be three people I'll invite right now, and I'll introduce them one at a time, but they can come up collectively when I'm done. Jim Park is the CEO and founder of the Mortgage Collaborative. Jim provides day-to-day oversight of the Mortgage Collaborative business initiatives and works closely with TMC's board of directors to ensure that the company achieves its annual and long-term goals. With nearly 30 years in the housing and mortgage banking field, Park has held various positions in the corporate sector, starting several businesses, worked in federal and local governments, and helped to launch a number of prominent nonprofit organizations. Second on the panel will be Doug Duncan, chief economist of Fannie Mae. Doug is Fannie Mae's vice president, chief economist. He's responsible for managing Fannie Mae's strategy division and economics and mortgage market analysis groups. He is a frequent speaker on national and state economic, housing, and mortgage market conditions. He's been named to the Business Week 50 Most Powerful People in Real Estate. And last for the panel, John Burns, CEO of John Burns Real Estate Consulting. John founded John Burns Real Estate Consulting in 2001 to help executives make informed investment decisions. The company research subscribers receive the most accurate analysis possible to inform their micro investment decisions. and the company's consulting clients receive specific property and portfolio investment advice designed to maximize profits. John co-authored Big Shifts Ahead, Demographic Clarity for Businesses, a book written to help make demographic trends easier to understand. We would welcome all three of you up to the top or the front. Doug, I'm going to ask you a question, and some of this will be, it'll be interconnected, and anybody that wants to comment, welcome to do that. Today, the U.S. economy has about a 2% GDP growth, a 50-year low unemployment rate, inflation under control. Why are bond yields so low? And we just recently inverted with those types of stats.
It's a great question. If I knew the answer completely, I'd tell the Fed, because they'd like to know too. We're the best looking horse outside the glue factory.
Okay.
I was raised on a farm, so that's as a visual. But if you look at our tenure, it's at, right now I think it's about 1.7.
Yep.
But most of the developed countries in the world actually have negative rates at the 10-year. So we're growing. 2% growth is pretty good. Typically, economists think about the rate at which the economy can grow without inflationary pressures as being the sum of the growth in your workforce on an annual basis plus productivity gains. So we're not too far from that. We think that's about 2.25% going forward, so we're pretty close to that. So it's the U.S., relative to other countries around the world, pretty good place to be. The question of why inflation hasn't come, that's the issue that the Fed would like an answer to.
This influence outside of our own borders, mm-hmm. Are their economies likely to worsen and put more downward pressure on our interest rates?
That's certainly a possibility. China is clearly slowing. That is one of the effects of the trade discussion that's going on, is they're actually about twice as sensitive to trade as a share of their GDP as the U.S. is. And so you've seen recently some easing of credit conditions. Even some of that will flow into their shadow banking system, which is a real concern for them today. So there's no question that people are worrying about whether the U.S. is actually isolated from those effects of slowing in other countries. We're still the biggest economy in the world. China's second biggest. So as China slows, it does have an impact, but not as much on the U.S. as it does other trading partners of theirs around the world.
So looking at the Fed's actions, are the interest rate reductions in the U.S. kind of a preemptive rather than necessary?
So for those of you whose lives are so exciting that you watch the press conference of the Federal Reserve Chairman, there are all of the economists that, you know, we typically form our cocktail parties around Fed press conferences. But I do watch them because there are some clues. And in the rate cut that they issued in July, they called it a mid-course correction, which the suggestion then is that the economy is actually doing okay, but the risks are on the downside, so we'll just temper it a little bit, be a little bit easier on money. So we're listening in September to see, does he use the words mid-course correction, or does the word insurance show up? Hmm. In fact, he used the word insurance, which suggests their view is that the risks are greater to the downside than they were. We actually have another rate cut in our forecast in December on the insurance idea.
If we go back a year ago when we had this meeting, the anticipation was we were going to have 3 rate hikes.
That's right.
Going forward. Now we're probably going to have 3 rate cuts.
Yep.
That's a big difference.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And real estate's feeling the effects of that, right? We saw the run-up in rates to that expectation late last year bled over into the market the first half of this year.
Okay. John, when I see that your business only was started in 2001, I mean, it's an amazing accomplishment, first of all, because when you got started, you had a nice run for builders, but when you and I really got to know each other, you invited me to debate to some very smart people in 2005 and 2006. At the time that that went on, your clientele was basically builders, correct?
Yes.
And okay, I mean,
yeah,
so,
I had to pivot.
Well, but, and that's a great word. And I listened to one of your where you were being interviewed, and that's a word that you use, and that's an astonishing pivot because almost all the builders that survived had to do exactly the same.
Yeah, and maybe thanks to you, a number of my builders actually sold their company before the real, you know what, hit the fan. So, you know, nobody can time this stuff right, but I think you can figure out when the risks are higher than usual, and I think there's a parallel with what's going on right now. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen next year, but I'm confident the risks are higher than usual. And so that's how our clients are running their business again.
But as you expanded your client base, you've also added to your life kind of the input from very smart people
right.
across the board, and that for you, that has to be a pretty cool experience.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I've got 250 of the smartest clients out there who pay us every month to make me smart. I mean, that's pretty good deal. So
that's a pretty good business model.
Yeah.
Has the urgency or animal spirit to own a home changed from when it was like when I was a young adult?
Oh, yeah.
Man, that was it.
It's totally yeah. I mean. I'll say it another way. I think the animal spirits to own anything has changed. In that demographic research book we did, it was very clear to me that we nicknamed those born in the 1980s the sharers because they basically invented the sharing economy. They're like, why do I need to own anything when there's an efficient way to rent something? And it starts with prom dresses, and it's been going, you know, houses and Airbnb, and I'm just going to borrow stuff. I'm going to borrow a bike. I'm going to, you know, take one of those go cars. Same thing with a house. I mean, they don't like rent hikes. They like to own. They would like to own their own stuff. I think most of them are going to become homeowners, but are they going to achieve the home ownership rate as their parents? I would say the odds of that are less than 1%. I mean, they're just not going to get there. And well, the reason I say that with some confidence is not just attitude. The GDP growth on the last 20 years has been a full point lower than the prior 20 years. So they just haven't had the same economic tailwinds.
Well, when you look at the numbers for people that retire with their home free and clear and retire as a renter, that's not a pretty sight.
No, I know.
Okay. So are they going to make that money in another direction or are they not going to?
So let's look at it through their lens. You know, it's not a pretty sight in their lens to see their parents get thrown out in a foreclosure. And when they hear the word if you're born in the 1990s, the word recession means foreclosure. It's the same thing. And so, I mean, they want to be homeowners, but my clients have done some really interesting research on that. A lot of them are not stretching as much as you would think. They'll stretch on the down payment. They're putting nothing down. But I still, you know, I don't want to go up to my eyeballs, particularly in California, interestingly, and particularly the college-educated people in California.
And we see that in our data, the flow through our data, that this group has the smallest share contributing more than 30% of their annual income to buy a house of any of the last three generations. Much more conservative.
Yeah, I don't mean to say a lot of people aren't stretching because I've got a lot of data to show people are stretching. But
what's the main reason to buy today?
It's because I'm ready to settle down and have a family and I'm stable. And that's another part of it. You know, the job used to take a job and be someplace for 30 years. Now you know, hey, it's probably not going to be. And even if I want to be here for 30 years, it's not my choice. And even in big markets like Phoenix, Phoenix is a good example. If you buy a home on the west side of Phoenix and then decide to take a job on the east side of Phoenix, you got to move. I mean, the traffic. Some of these sprawl markets have really. And everybody's a dual income household too. So both of you have to have a job on the west side of Phoenix. It just creates a lot of psychological barriers.
Jim, what was the year the Mortgage Collaborative started?
We started about 6.5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, with a kind of a concept that that we thought, you know, lenders could learn from each other, support each other's growth. So what we do is right now we have about 170 lenders from throughout the country that are members of the organization. We benchmark their performance against each other. We help to raise, elevate their performance level in terms of our operation and efficiency. It's an important issue in this environment. Right now, the average cost to produce a loan is $10,000. It was about $8,000 about a year ago, and it was much lower. If you go back 5 years, it was much, much lower. Now, there were some issues around regulatory costs that were embedded into that added cost of producing a loan. But there's, you know, higher loan officer comp and other things that kind of that played out that makes it very hard for lenders to survive in this market. And frankly, a lot of our members were struggling at the beginning of the year before the rates started to drop. Everyone's feeling really good again, but you know, as you know, in this business, it's a very cyclical business, and so we expect that to last for a little bit. I don't know. I'm not sure how long you think it's going to last, but hopefully, it'll last a little longer. But you know, it'll come back to that the balloon will come back down again, or the bubble will come back down again, and so we're expecting to try to run the business more efficiently yet again.
So you ultimately rely more on purchase than now. So there's other avenues of loans. So are you interested in, let's say somebody gets aggressive with loans to investors and stops saying 4 or 10, maybe that's 30 would be the number or something like that. Would that have an impact on your clients being able to make money?
You know, the bulk of the business today, and Doug knows this very well, bulk of the business still today is a very safe and sound lending. And so sort of these aggressive lending products that are in the marketplace is still a small piece of the business. So I think just generally book of business today is better than ever. That's why I think, you know, a lot of people were concerned about the bubble and, you know, what the market will potentially hold a few years down the line. But you are creating some of the best manufactured loan we've seen in our history. And so I don't have as big a concern about the potential mortgage downturn in that same way. There are other issues at play in terms of the broad economics, but in terms of the mortgage side, actually bringing the economy down, I don't think we have that issue ahead of us.
Yeah, one of the things we track is what we call early payment defaults. That is when a loan is new, how many of those loans go into delinquency 30, 60, or 90 days, how soon. Those numbers are the lowest they've been in over 20 years. So to Jim's point, the quality of the loans that are on the books, and also to John's point, a lot of those are younger people that are being much more conservative. Partly it's the tightening of underwriting criteria that has supported that, but it is factual that it's unlikely that the mortgage space will be the problem next time around.
When you look at the current lending laws that are still in place, does it indicate that we're still going after safety first, or are we trying to get the percentage of owner-occupants up again, the people that own their own homes?
You know, in Doug's point around kind of the low level of delinquency that we are experiencing in the market, a historic low, it does sort of tell you that maybe it could loosen up a little bit. Obviously, that has a direct correlation to how wide the door is to let people into getting financing. Although I do find that people, and to the builder side, I think supply, I would say, what I've heard is that's the bigger issue, less so the kind of the credit availability in the market.
The supply of what?
Housing.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's a bigger issue. You got plenty of people looking for housing. They got financing behind them, but they can't buy the house that they want or afford. And I think that's been sort of the particularly at the mid-level or the startup mid-level, I think that's where people are struggling. And so I think we can try to create more buyers, but we got to find places for them to buy, right? So that's the challenge, I think, ahead for us.
I just want to bring some clarity to the mortgage thing, because this is what we were talking about earlier. Like, the mortgage underwriting isn't tight in every aspect. So the documentation is as tight as ever. So if you don't have great documentation, it's tough. if you don't have a FICO score of 640 or above, it's a little tough. It's a lot tougher than it was 10 years ago, but pretty comparable. About 10% of the mortgages are going to those people, and that was similar to the 1990s. So they could loosen on documentation, and they can loosen more loans to the sub 640. We have 57% of mortgages putting 10% down or less, which is the highest ever. So it's not the debt. The down payment is as loose as ever. And Dodd-Frank came up with an arbitrary number, 42 or 43%. We should not be above somebody's gross debt-to-income ratio, and except for Fannie, Freddie, and FHA, we're going to let them slide. So 43% of all mortgages are above 43% debt-to-income ratio. So we're not loose on down payment. I mean, we're not tight on down payment, and I don't think we're tight on debt-to-income either.
Yeah,
Go ahead. I think part of the reason why you see the sort of trending down of the down payment amount is because home prices have moved
sure.
up, right? And so I think for people, I mean, you talk about an average, you know, teacher or fireman and how long it takes them to get 10% or 20% down, it's quite substantial. And so if people want to jump into the market, I think that's all only option they have is to go towards more of the low down payment product, and both Fannie, Freddie, and FHA, obviously, you have a vehicle for making that happen. So.
Yeah, but the point is that product is there.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is the thing that is different than in the 2004, 5, 6 timeframe is that the underwriting process now is diligent about what they call layered risks. So if you have a spotty employment record in today, it might be okay as long as you've got good savings and you have a good record on repaying your debt. But if you have a spotty employment record and a weak record on repaying your debts, and you don't have savings, you're unlikely going to get that low down payment loan, right? So the underwriting has removed those layered risks. We survey households, 1,000 a month. We've been doing that since June of 2010, and we then on each quarter we survey the universe of mortgage lenders. And we've watched the parallel recognition of both households and lenders of the pace of slowdown in credit easing. So starting at the post-crisis period in the 2010 period, credit underwriting was very tight. It's gradually been easing, and both consumers and lenders have recognized that. Part of it is our rules, so we're part of what's driving that. But over the last year, it's flattened out. And in the most recent quarterly survey of lenders, there was actually marginal tightening in every group except the part that Jim was talking about, that private label issuance, which is less than 5% of the total market. But there was actually slight tightening. FHA tightened a little bit of rules. The debt-to-income ratio that John talked about, we saw some layered risks emerging there. We tightened a little bit of rule. That was translated into the industry very quickly.
Okay. Okay, it's been in the news every night for a week. I got to ask. Okay, repo market. It's not a repo like we're used to. It's not a repossession. It's a repurchase, correct?
The Fed only wishes it was a kind of repo that you're thinking.
So there's been a lot of billions of dollars that have had to be added to shore up something. I'm not an expert on this, but I've tried to make myself a little bit familiar. Basically what happens is you have lenders that have money and you have lenders that need money. And what occurs is the lender that needs money actually gives up ownership of something. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And has to rebuy it within a certain tight time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Why was there a shortage of $75 billion in that exchange? And now it's going to what, October 2nd, and could add up to $2 trillion? Okay.
So I'm going to pitch watching the Fed press releases or press conferences again. I'm going to get at least one of you to join me, and we'll have drinks. Because liquidity, as we know, is very important, right? That's why you have drinks.
liquidity or lubrication?
Well, yeah, either. They work together. Yeah. So in the press conference, the chairman was asked, did this surprise you? And he said, no, because it happened in December, although at a much lower level. And so, but what did surprise us was the magnitude. And then he quickly said, but of course it surprised the market as well. So then the question was asked, well, why? What's the cause? And he said, we don't fully know. That's a troubling statement, right? But it's also an honest
statement. It's an honest statement, that's but right. We don't want him to do that, I guess.
That's right. So it is true that the whole capital markets community is attempting to understand this, and there's not a good, solid answer to it. If you really want to get into this, there is a guy named Zoltan Poznar that is an analyst for UBS, and he's been warning about this for about a year. I'm going to get a name change because Zoltan is a much better name than Doug. So,
like you know, yeah. Right off.
Well, we had him come to the company this past week because we wanted to talk to him about this because we put a lot of money, because of the mortgage payments that come through our business, we put a lot of money into the cash component of that repo market, right? And so we are concerned about the fact that it's difficult to understand. Part of it is the huge volume of issuance of treasuries that's having to be done because of the deficits that we're running. And there are 24 companies that have been granted access to the treasury. They're called primary dealers. You can look it up on the web and you can see who they are, 24 global banks. And they're the ones that actually execute the sale of treasuries into the market. And that's where the reserves either shrink in the banking system or increase, depending on whether they're selling or buying. So that's one of the things, is the magnitude of the issuance of treasuries. And those institutions all have capital rules that say, on a daily basis, what their liquidity has to be. So they will go into the market, and if they need more liquidity, they will be dedicating some of those treasuries to the trading partner, who will then give them cash to meet their regulatory requirement. Then the next day, they sell those treasuries back at an incremental nightly interest rate, right?
Right.
That's a piece of it. It's also the case that on a quarterly basis, there are corporations that have to meet tax issuances. And so some of them access cash, typically through the money market funds, which also has to do with the reserves on bank balances. And that also happened.
What is their collateral? Is it bonds?
It's the same. It's typically treasuries or agency securities.
Okay.
So those are a couple of the things, but that's not all of it. And I'm not going to pretend to understand everything that Poznar has written about it. I've been trying to make my way through it. We're trying to understand. He doesn't fully understand the elements, but he's been the one person who's been really accurate that this is going to be a problem. He suggests it will ultimately drive the Fed to expand its balance sheet and drive the funds rate to zero.
That was one of my questions, is the act of what they're doing actually already doing that? Adding to that balance.
So the follow-up to Governor Powell's question was, given that you're not fully sure, but there is a liquidity issue, you've said that you would start to let the Fed balance sheet grow organically. There was a New York Times reporter asked, shouldn't you give consideration to actually increasing it today to a higher level because of those reserve requirements, and then let it grow organically? And he said, no, that's not what we're going to do. There was another follow-up question that said, shouldn't you stand up a permanent repurchase facility? Mm-hmm. And he said, not at this time. So they're still trying to understand the dimensions of the issue, and it does have some global components to it, because some of those primary dealers are global bank components.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan and Associates, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Shenbaum Group, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering, Wilson Investment Properties. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.